You're listening to Action Magazine, the podcast, the weekly download on what's shaping in the future of film, festivals, and the creative voices behind entertainment. I'm your host, Victoria, filmmaker, documentarist, and editor-in-chief of Action Magazine. From solo insights to on-the-ground festival coverage and stories from across the creative world, this podcast keeps you in action. Welcome to episode 19 of Action Magazine, the podcast. In today's episode, we're going to have a conversation with award-winning filmmaker Sean King O'Grady about his new docuseries, Suspicious Minds. Let's get to it.
Hi.
Hi.
I do love your background, I have to say that. Amazing. best Zoom interview I've ever done.
Well, hopefully you can hear and see me okay. If you need me to tweak anything, let me know.
That's perfect. Thank you so much. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about your background, if you can give me a brief introduction about yourself.
Yeah, for sure. So I've been making films of all kinds for a long time. So I make narrative films and documentaries. And this project has been really interesting. It's been a passion project of mine for a while. And we were considering taking this in a more traditional direction where it would become either a feature-length documentary or a documentary series that we would pitch to streamers, et cetera. And it was originally about delusions and psychosis more generally.
Yeah.
And based on the Golds book, Joel and Ian Gold, who are featured in the series, their book, Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. And then the AI delusions started to emerge. And we realized that traditionally, the path for a documentary or a documentary series is it's like 18 to 24 months, best case, yeah, from when you start until when it finally reaches an audience. And we realized because of the urgency of what was happening and the fact that this technology is so new and the way it's affecting people's minds is so new and so urgent that we didn't have that much time to wait, which is why we ended up releasing it in this format, which is a documentary series on YouTube and then a podcast.
Yeah, it's a very interesting format. I'm a filmmaker myself, and I love documentaries. I love doing them. I love working with people to do documentaries. I think it's amazing to tell real stories and to explore all that. And the format that you picked is so unique. Can you dive a little deeper in that and explaining how did you decide to go with that? What is the process behind making an episode? How does everything work and come together?
Yeah, so it was interesting. We were like building the plane as we were flying it. And it was really trying to figure out, look, since I usually don't go here in these interviews, but since this isn't since you're writing from the perspective of someone from the industry,
yeah,
I can say this. Like, the documentary industry is extremely challenged right now.
Yeah.
And people are trying to figure out how to finance documentaries, how to distribute documentaries. And for the longest time, there was like a bit of a formula of you make the documentary, you get into a good festival, you get good distribution. And there are movies that are like winning awards at Sundance that still aren't getting distribution.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And so for us, I think it was always in the back of our minds that at some point we would make something that we would distribute in this way, which is using the technology and the tools that exist now from a distribution standpoint that didn't exist in this way 5-6 years ago. And then the timing of this story where something urgent popped up and, yeah, it was like, okay, this is no longer a desire to distribute something on our own. This is a need to distribute something on our own to get it to audiences at the speed that the story is unfolding. And then also, I think it's a combination of things. It's not just obviously YouTube, podcasts, social media, these things that existed for a long time.
Yeah.
But I think audiences' expectations of what they see on which platform are changing. Like, if you look at the data, people are watching YouTube on their television more over the past few years. Yeah. And so I think where formally what we wanted to do with this is I wanted to take the advantages that the podcast format has, but also make something that I felt was cinematic and that, yeah, had high production values. And I was really happy, just like purely from an artistic standpoint, with where we landed on this format, where if there's a guest who's saying something, if there's a person who's telling their story and they want to tell that story for 2, 3, 4 minutes, you don't feel that need that you do in a traditional documentary to cut away to something, to cut to B-roll, to cut to verite. These things that I like that are immersive, but sometimes the most immersive thing when someone's telling a powerful story is just to look them in the eyes and hear them tell that story. And this format allowed for that in a way that honestly I think will apply to my future work, whether that is a more traditional streaming project or a traditional theatrical documentary or something like this. And honestly, I'm so fired up about what we've been able to do with this and how I feel about the way the process worked and the way at least I feel the results are, that I think I'm very enthused about doing more of this in the future just because it's been so liberating, kind of in every imaginable way.
And how did you decide to go with YouTube and that platform specifically? Was there something to draw you to it?
It was a combination of factors. I think the freedom that YouTube allows of saying no one can stop me. I'm not waiting for permission. I think for the most part, documentary storytellers are bold by nature. They're telling stories that other people aren't telling, and they're willing to take the personal risk of saying, I'm going to put myself on the line and make this thing that everyone might hate, but I know I love. And to have like traditional gatekeepers stand between you and that story reaching an audience just isn't necessary anymore. And sure, not everything can be a YouTube series necessarily or a YouTube feature necessarily. But I do think that since audiences are watching YouTube more on their TVs, since I think it's a thing we talk about in the industry a lot of, and I'm sure you hear this from a lot of filmmakers that you talk to, talking about what audience expectations are for different platforms. And I personally think we are way overthinking it. I think whether someone is watching something on Netflix on their TV or YouTube on their TV or Netflix vertically on their phone, I think people are watching films in so many different ways now that it's really up to filmmakers to say, all right, I'm not going to have this limiting belief in my head that my film or my series isn't real because it's not a Netflix original or because it didn't play at this festival. It's like, no, let's do what the end goal of this always was from the beginning, which is to bring powerful stories to audiences, and we need to find them where they are, and YouTube is where the audience is today.
That makes total sense. And I love that because a lot of people don't know where to put their projects. They don't get picked up and then they give up. And it's sad because they make this amazing project, they tell this amazing story, and then nobody sees it. So I think YouTube is such a wonderful tool if used in the right way. And it's amazing what you're doing because a lot of people will see that it's so powerful and everyone's watching because everyone's there in YouTube. So it's amazing. Can you talk a little bit about the team behind making each episode? What are the different skills that you need to create this, the different people in your crew that you need to make this happen? How is that collaboration process?
It's evolved over the course of making this. So we have what I would consider an extremely small team from a traditional documentary or certainly from a documentary series standpoint, but we probably have a bigger team than a lot of YouTube projects you think of for YouTube or projects that you think of for podcasts outside of, there are much larger, more heavily produced podcasts that have huge teams. But we're existing sort of in that middle space. So we have a couple of producing partners. We have an editor, a lead editor who does the first edit of every series. And these are people I've worked with for I have got to bring a couple of my friends on this project who I've known for like 10 plus years, who we all used to work together. It's really fun. We used to work together creating pitch tapes for a documentary series. And now to be able to take that same team and do what we said we wanted to do a decade ago, which is if we could only get to make like the real thing that people are going to see, now we're doing it. No one's stopping us. It's really cool. And then we have, I think, our total team between the team that does the graphics, team that does the editing, the team that does our social media, everything. It's like maybe 9 people total. I think it might be longer. We throw the credits on YouTube. That's one thing that I know a lot of people do that. We're not like breaking new ground, but I do think it's important the way that that films traditionally have a credit crawl at the end. And I
Yeah.
think as we adjust to the new ways of distributing our projects, we need to figure out how to still honor the people who worked on the projects. And no one's going to sit on YouTube and watch a credit crawl at the end of a series. They're just not going to. I
Yeah.
don't even think, I know a lot of podcasts will list off the credits at the end in an audio sense.
Yeah.
I don't think people are listening. I think people skip that.
Yeah.
So I throw it in the show notes and give credit to everybody. I am not going to try to list everybody audibly right now because I don't want to bore your listeners or your readers. And I also don't want to forget anybody
Yeah,
because
that's
it
true.
really is, especially with a really small team, everybody is absolutely critical.
Yeah.
And that's what, this is my favorite way to work, to be honest. Even if we had the resources of a Netflix or Hulu or Apple series, I still think like the intimacy of doing
Yeah.
this with a small team of people who you rely on, every single person who is there, and you trust those people to
Yeah.
deliver when they say they're going to deliver. It's just a really good feeling. It's a good like esprit de corps and a really fun way to work.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more with that. And how long does it take from start to finish to make an episode, from the pre-production to actually shooting to the edit?
It's a little different with each one. So a lot of our episodes are, there are pieces of interviews that were shot over the course of several months. And so there's not an exact,
Yeah.
like, it takes us 4 days to make it. On average, it takes us about a week and a half to
Okay.
make an episode. And that would be, you know, I'm fudging some things to make that make sense, but I think that's a good average. I think between a week and a week and a half.
Okay. And the next question I have, I think a lot of people may have curiosity to know, do you need any sort of permission to, I don't know, use the footage that you use sometimes or to talk about the information that you talk about? How does that work? Is that completely freedom, like you can say whatever you want to say, you can use whatever you want to use for those episodes? How does that work?
I clear everything with a lawyer
Okay.
first. So I don't really want to answer that question because I don't want to give anybody bad advice.
Yes.
I would say it's evolving. And I think that obviously within documentaries versus narrative, you have a little more freedom because there are some First Amendment protections
Yeah.
in terms of the way that you use certain things. But yeah, I would punt that question to someone far more qualified than
Yeah.
myself.
So definitely having an entertainment lawyer is a must for this, for some moments.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think so. I think that's for me, if I were to say something that I think a lot of people probably skip, especially
Yeah.
with what, you know, the term, okay, let me get on a soapbox for a second. The term direct to consumer gets used a lot for projects like this, and I don't want to use that anymore. I want to use direct to audience. I think that that's what we should be talking about
Yes.
because consumer, I don't know, something about consumer doesn't feel as good as audience. I
Yeah,
think
that's
that
true.
this is, I don't like the idea of consuming content. I don't
Yeah.
like those words. It just feels, I don't know, it feels kind of gross in a sense, as
Yeah.
opposed to viewing or experiencing content. And granted, I realize this is a completely semantic discussion, but I do think when we're talking about this, words do matter and they do affect the way and the framing for which someone's going to experience something.
That's awesome. And what do you hope people will take away or feel when watching each episode? What is your end goal here for the audience?
I have never been a part of something where we were addressing a topic that doesn't have any answers.
Yeah.
And it was a really fun way to go into this. I think fun, and I have to be careful with this because I don't ever want to be caught calling my own work important, but the subject is important.
Yeah.
And I think that's where what I would like the audience to take away from it is, we don't know yet how artificial intelligence is going to affect the human mind. And there are some people doing incredible work. There are some people who have been unfortunately impacted by this in very real ways that has like really disrupted their lives. There are
Yeah.
people who've ended their lives. It's
Yeah.
the stakes are really high when it comes to how this technology is going to affect our minds and how it's going to affect society. Like, I
Yeah.
really do think that this is, that artificial intelligence in the way that it's currently being used by society is going to transform society as much as the automobile, as much as the
Yeah.
internet. And specifically, I think most recently we have the smartphone and social media, which are two technologies that we've adopted into society that we are terrible at. And we're like, no one, like, name a person who doesn't have a smartphone addiction to some extent.
Exactly.
It's almost impossible. Everybody does. We're terrible at using using smartphones. We're terrible at using social media. I want to see our audience think about how we can become better at implementing artificial intelligence into our lives, because like, the cat is out of the bag. The toothpaste does not go back in the tube. This technology is here.
Yes.
Some people love it. Some people hate it. I think most people are probably in the middle somewhere where they're a little scared of it, but they're trying to figure out how to use it. Or maybe they find some uses of ChatGPT really convenient.
Yeah.
And that reminds me so much of what phones were like and social media in the early days of those technologies. I don't want to see us repeat those mistakes. So I want, if the audience takes away anything, it's a sense of curiosity and a sense of purpose in understanding this technology, how each one of us will implement its use into our own lives, and what we as a society want out of technology versus the technology getting what it wants out of us.
Exactly. I love that. And I think it's so relevant today because we're in a phase that we're shifting a lot into the AI things and tools, and a lot of people are using that professionally. And it's scary how fast it's growing. And I was going to ask you, feel free to answer this however you want. How do you feel about AI in the creative field, in the entertainment industry?
I have really mixed feelings on its on AI's use when it comes to, I think, art in general.
Yeah.
I want to be realistic about it because there's a part of me that when I engage with any piece of art, whether it's a film, whether it's a painting, whether it's a photograph, I see that as being a relationship that I'm having with the person who made it. And it's their artistic intent that I'm then interpreting or I'm pulling some sort of meaning from.
Yeah.
And when there isn't a human behind that, what am I interacting with? What is that? What is the intent of it? I don't know. But then when it comes to some use of some AI tools, like I like to use this example. If I hire a graphic designer to make something for me, it can be anything. Let's say it's poster. Let's say it's motion graphics for my project. I typically don't ask them what tools they're using.
Yeah.
They could be using Photoshop. They could be using After Effects. And if I found out, well, first of all, the entire Adobe suite is loaded with AI.
Yeah.
And I think all of us are using it, right? Like how many Adobe products are you using?
I use a bunch. I use a bunch. Yeah. And all of them have the AI now. And sometimes it's tempting because it saves so much time for mundane tasks that you might need, especially like just cleaning some things in the graphics, things like that. So it does save time. So that's why I'm also in the middle like you, because the time saving is great, but also I don't like it to be creative for me because that's my profession. And I follow this career path because that's my passion since I was a kid and I don't want to leave that behind. So I feel guilty if I do, but I use that to save time in certain things that are not creative in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense to me. And I think that's what we need to figure out is, also, we need to be intellectually honest about the fact that we've been using, before it was generative AI, there was machine learning tools that we were using in our creative suites of tools for years.
Yeah.
And none of us had a problem with it. We just did it and used it and didn't think about it or talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to be realistic about, yes, not outsourcing our creativity. I think that's a really dangerous path to go down, both for the people who are... we just don't know. Obviously, anything that you are seeing, hearing, it makes you feel something.
Yeah.
And we don't know how that's going to affect our psychology if we're taking in all this. And not all of it is slop. I guess the term slop gets thrown around a lot. But like, if we're taking in all this AI slop, or we're taking in this art that's made by these machines whose intent we don't understand, we don't know what that's going to do to our minds. So that's first and foremost for me. But then also not being just completely foot down anti-AI, anti-generative AI. Yeah. I think that we will find our way. We just need to bring our morals and ethics to it and do what each artist is comfortable with. And then I think that audiences will decide what they're comfortable with and we'll meet somewhere in a place where we're not just outsourcing this creativity, because that is the concern, right? Is we lose those skills, and then you can't say what you wanted to say, or you don't even know what you want to say, because a lot of times, I'm sure I find this, I'm sure you find this, you think you want to say one thing, but it's only through doing the work that you realize it was some other thing that was in the back of your mind that just needed to get out. And if we lose that, I think we really lose a lot of what it is that makes us human.
Exactly. Couldn't agree more. And finding that middle ground, I think it's so important, especially for the creative field, because we can't lose the creativity. We can lose the human feeling behind every story. I think that's so unique. That's why I love documentaries, because it's those real stories really inspire me. You've worked across many different projects. What is the main difference that you find on creating a feature or a show compared to this work that you're doing now?
The two major differences between what we're doing now, okay, I'll give you three. So one is permission. There's a lot less permission needed to make the kind of thing we're making now, because it, even though I have a relatively large team for something that is direct to audience like this, this is still a fraction of the cost to produce of even the lowest budget documentary.
Yeah.
And so that the less money that you need to spend to make something that you feel really great about, that's less permission that you need to ask, even of yourself. If you're the one who's putting your own resources into it, then on a distribution side, there's less permission, because I'm not going around asking streaming platforms or theaters or anyone to bring this to an audience. We're doing it ourselves using the platforms that exist. And the third part is those things all sound really great. They all sound really romantic from a creative standpoint. But you also realize while doing this, all the things that those distributors or streamers were doing to release and promote your work. And so you realize you're truly on your own, and that there isn't going to be some cavalry that comes in to save you and make sure that you find an audience. You need to be thinking about that audience before you make the project. And while you don't have to ask permission of any of these large companies or financing entities to make your work, you need to ask permission of the audience. You need to make something that's worthy of the audience's time.
Yeah.
And you also need to let them know that it exists.
Yes.
And so that's been the most unique challenge of this, is making sure that we can find those audiences. You can't just throw something up on YouTube and say, hey guys, we're here.
Yeah.
You really need to do the work to make sure that, and we're still doing that. We're still figuring that out. It's a work in progress. And I think if we talked again in 6 months, I would have a lot more information, because it's just that distribution side of things is evolving every day.
Definitely. If you could use three words to describe this docuseries, what would they be?
Urgent, enlightening, surprising.
Great choices.
Enlightening and surprising are a little close there, but I think there's enough nuance between the two that
definitely
you'll get something different.
Definitely. And what can we expect to see from you in the future from this docuseries? Where is this all going? Do you have any more work lined up?
Yeah, we actually just started to, it's wild. And I think this speaks to the nature of the speed of this type of distribution, is some data came out about that ChatGPT released last week about people's mental health states while engaging with the platform. And we did like a special episode that just addresses that data. And so I realized that's another layer of really freedom that you have with these platforms, is we have the ability to answer questions in real time, or actually ask more questions, is really what we're doing. There are no answers. If you come to this series looking for answers, you're going to the wrong place. It's all questions, asking questions based on more questions. But there are some other topics and some other things that I think are urgent that are in a similar space that I want to address in this same way. So there's more coming from my team in this exact format, because it's just like we're having the time of our lives making this and releasing it. And there will be more from Suspicious Minds, these episodes, and then we're working pretty quickly here on a second season.
That's amazing. And one of the last questions I have is, how do you make sure you you keep this informative but also entertaining, because when I was watching, it's so entertaining. You don't see the time pass, but you also get all this information. That's not easy to do sometimes when you're giving a lot of information. Sometimes people can zone off and it's boring. How do you manage to keep both working together, entertaining and informative?
I'm glad you felt that way about it because that was definitely the goal. That's the big challenge. And I think that is part of, I think for better or worse, like the documentary audience has exploded since Netflix got involved in the documentary game. And I think Netflix really pulled documentaries out of like the strictly PBS space, where I can tune into a PBS documentary, or if I go to like a library, for instance, to a public screening of a documentary where I'm just there to get information. That's one headspace of viewing something. But I think audiences now come to nonfiction expecting to be entertained. And so I'm always thinking of that first, is like you've got to balance the sugar and the medicine, or else people are going to tune out really, really quickly. Even the news isn't just information. The news is formatted in a way that it's entertaining. And we could talk all day about how potentially dangerous that is for all of us and for society. But I think that if we're being realistic about this, people are watching this for entertainment. Yes, they're walking away, hopefully having some profound insights or wanting to go ask more questions, or my highfalutin hopes for it are that people making this has genuinely made me reflect upon my own use of technology, not just AI, but all technology in my
All.
life. All. And I hope people walk away from this asking those same questions and really looking in the mirror and addressing their own use of technology the same way that I have. And that's also where I'm really a proxy for the audience in this project, in a way that I'm not an expert on technology. I'm not an expert on psychology. And no one yet is an expert on the psychology of AI use to this extent. Like, we do have some people who are emerging experts in that space, but it's so new. It's so incredibly new that everyone's just figuring it out. And I think when you're presenting information that can potentially be so, I don't know, heavy, I guess, that the more entertaining it is, the more likely you are to actually stick with people and for them to listen to your message, even if your message is simply questions.
Exactly. It's very eye-opening, everything that you mentioned in each episode. It's very eye-opening and very relevant today. And everyone's questioning AI and technology nowadays more and more. So I think it makes that even more entertaining because it's very eye-opening and we think about our actions a lot. So I love that about it. Do you have any social media pages that people can follow, stay updated with the show or with your work?
Yeah, our everything for Suspicious Minds, it's all at Agoric Media. So we have Instagram at Agoric Media, the YouTube is at Agoric Media, TikTok is at Agoric Media. I'm forgetting, I'm somewhat new to the social media game. And then personal pages are all just at Sean King O'Grady.
Perfect. Is there anything else that you'd like to share that I might have missed or skipped?
No, I don't think so. I think just that new episodes are coming out weekly,
Okay.
and the primary places to find the episode, video is at YouTube, audio is at Spotify and Apple or wherever you find podcasts. Like, I think it's easiest to tell people just to search, go to your platform of choice and search for Suspicious Minds AI or Suspicious Minds Psychosis.
Perfect. That's wonderful. Those are all the questions I have. It was wonderful to get to know you and your work. Congratulations again on the docuseries. It's an amazing format. It's unique, and I love unique things. I think we need more of that, more authentic things, and you're doing that. So that's amazing. I hope that to see more people do similar work to yours, because that's what we need. And if you ever need me to talk about any other projects that you have, it will be a pleasure. Our doors are always open for you.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for your insightful commentary on it and for the great questions.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks for listening to Action Magazine, the podcast. Keep creating, keep dreaming, and stay in action. Catch you next week.